Introduce Steve Fuller, who is going to give the last paper today on Alexander Coiret, internalist or esotericist historian of science. And Steve Fuller is Auguste Comte professor of social epistemology in the Department of Sociology at the University of Warwick. He is very well known, having published many, many books on the history of science and on for example, his next book is on knowledge, the philosophical quest for in history, which is going to be published by Routledge very soon. Please help me welcome Steve Fuller.
Okay. Thank you. This is on? Everything's okay? Okay, first of all, thank you, Elise, for inviting me. To be honest with you, I'm glad I'm the last speaker because I really wanted to get a sense of what people's take on Coiret is these days. And I do find that there are some things that I can say that haven't been said yet. First of all, let me say something about, you might not know why I'm even here, if you know something about my work. One of the books that I published over a dozen years ago now was called Thomas Kuhn, A Philosophical History for Our Time. And in preparation for this conference, I had a look at that book again, and it turns out I actually cite Coiret in 100 places in the book. He's a very important figure for the kind of picture that I paint of Kuhn, because I basically see Kuhn as straddling between two very intellectually and institutionally powerful figures, one being James Bryant Conant and the other being Coiret. And in a sense, part of my argument in the Kuhn book is that Kuhn is a very unhappy marriage between the two. That in a sense, Conant and Coiret had a much better sense of what they were respectively about than Kuhn did about himself. Okay, so that's kind of what the... And the thing about Coiret, the way I talk about him in the book, is as a kind of esotericist, that there is a sense in which what we call the internal history of science or the philosophical history of science is a species of a kind of esoteric history of science. And we heard a little bit earlier today about the relationship between Coiret and Leo Strauss. But I want to contextualize this part of the story a little more broadly, kind of in a way I'm a little surprised hasn't come up yet. And that's in terms of the Russian context, and in particular, the whole Slavophile movement that Coiret sort of comes out of when he's coming out of Russia into France. I think it's very important to realize that among the many things that Coiret did, he wrote the first book on the whole Slavophile philosophical movement that was published in French in 1950. And so Coiret is actually part of a group of people. The other important figure in which is Alexander Kojève. Okay, and it seems to me that you got to think of these two guys together. And while we normally think about Kojève these days, certainly as a very influential interpreter of Hegel, as the beginning of what's called, at least in the English-speaking world, the French Hegel. Nevertheless, what is important, and Kojève is usually classified as a kind of Marxist, and Coiret certainly wasn't a Marxist, but what both of them were Hegelians. Okay, and I think here, in terms of some of the sort of style of thinking that one finds in Coiret, one has to look at a certain way in which Hegelian idealism was interpreted in Russia in the 19th century, and it was primarily Hegel's books on the philosophy of history and religion and aesthetics that were primarily translated into Russian, and this is what those guys would have picked up when they were back in Russia before they came to France. And what this got very much intertwined with, so Hegel is sort of a Western influence that is influencing a native movement within Russia, which is nowadays called Cosmism. Cosmism, C-O-S-M-I-S-M, I don't know if you're familiar with this. One of the things, if you read I think it's in the little biography of me in there, you'll notice that in recent years I've been writing a lot about the future of humanity. and Humanity 2.0 and all this kind of stuff. And in this context nowadays, we have a movement called transhumanism, which is talking about projecting humanity into the cosmos, infinite life expectancy, all that kind of stuff. Well, one of the historical roots for this movement is cosmism, okay? And in particular, there is this 19th century philosopher, kind of a Russian Orthodox heretical, a heretic within the Russian Orthodoxy, by the name of Nikolai Fedorov. And Fedorov was influential on Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and all these kinds of people. He was of the idea, he took the idea of the divination of humanity, which is something that in certain circles of the Russian Orthodoxy was part of what the significance of Jesus was, that it was a sort of self-discovery of humanity's divinity, or the possibility of reclaiming that. And what this meant in terms of what Fedorov, the way he interpreted this, was very much in a scientific, even materialistic terms, as the possibility of humanity inhabiting the cosmos and conquering space, and a lot of that sort of thematic that you find very much part of Russian self-understanding, Soviet self-understanding in the 20th century, comes from this. Okay. Now, I think this is quite an important kind of way of thinking about humanity. You know, so in other words, the Earth is just where humanity begins, but it's not going to end there. It's going to permeate the cosmos, because that provides a certain kind of backdrop for interpreting Coiré's fascination with going from the closed world to the infinite universe. In this respect, I would say that Coiré's view of things goes totally against the kind of view of the history of science that you find Sigmund Freud promoting, right, where Sigmund Freud talks about the multiple displacements of humanity, right, that first Copernicus did it, right, when he showed that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe, and then Darwin did it when he showed that human beings weren't on top of the, you know, life, you know, and now Freud's coming along getting rid of reason, okay? Now, I think that, you know, there's certainly that story, but this is not Coiré's story. Coiré's story is more the idea that humanity comes to some kind of divine self-understanding through science. And in this respect, Newton is very much the important figure. And what he does is he manages to get, as it were, the God's point of view, the view from nowhere. And that's the thing that one is trying to capture in the scientific revolution, is kind of that potential for humans to epistemologically inhabit the divine standpoint. Okay, and I take it that that's kind of what, and if you look at the Russian cosmos, this is kind of what they're about. And in a way, what Coiré is doing is providing a kind of a historical account of when a human consciousness reached this point, right? And so this is where the significance of Galileo, I think, is very important there. And that the role of experimentation is to kind of open your mind to this kind of larger abstract reality, so this is a, I think, in terms of as a kind of a philosophical, general philosophical backdrop for where the motivation for what Coiré is doing. But on the other hand, there's also another aspect of this, and I think this is where Coiré differed quite a lot from the Russians who were promoting this back in Russia, because this trend remains in Russia and is very much part of the native Russian philosophical tradition. And as I said, it continues in a secular form in the Soviet period. But where I think Coiré differs, and this has to do with his movement to France and the issues of around World War II, is he believes that this situation is very precarious, right? In other words, just as much as we can discover how it is to acquire this godlike standpoint, we could easily lose it too, okay? And so then it becomes very important to think about what is the conditions of governance and so forth under which such things are possible. And here I do see Coiré as, generally speaking, sympathetic with a kind of double truth doctrine, of the sort associated with the Platonist tradition. And so there is the kind of the noble, the truth for the noble people, and this is the kind of the ability to see the forms underlying the sensuous appearances of nature. And as it were, experimentation and mathematics are important in disciplining the mind to enable you to see that. So in other words, mathematics and experimentation is not interesting in themselves, right? And they're certainly not interesting as technologies per se, but they're interesting as ways of opening up your mind so you can see the reality for what it is. And then, of course, there is this kind of lower sensuous order that ordinary people have, and this is kind of the thing that Aristotelianism was promoting under the guise of science, which was so abhorrent. And then you get to the Jesuits, as was mentioned in the first talk today, and you start to get this kind of attempt to put both of these views on an equal footing, right? And that's what Coiré calls lying, because in a sense, rather than doing the proper Platonic thing, which is to say you have a truth for the nobles and a truth for the masses, that at least keep the two things distinct so that you can have some kind of orderly society, what the Jesuits do is that they merge the two things again, say they're on an equal plane. Okay, and that just confuses everything. Okay, and so one of the themes that I talk about in the Kuhn book, which I think is very much part of Coiré's thinking, is this idea of how do you preserve intellectually and institutionally the quest for truth in a world where it is being, where in a sense we've kind of got an opening into it. So he's by no means a skeptic, right? He actually, there's a sense in which these stories that he's telling you about the scientific revolution is how you get to the truth. But how do you actually preserve the integrity of that, right, over time, given all the other demands that are being placed on science? Okay, it seems to me this is the kind of problematic, and I think this is kind of what makes him, from our own standpoint, quite an interesting figure. There's some aspects of the moves that Coiré makes that again, you know, I have not done the proper study of this, but I think if you go back to the Russian context, one of the things that there's a lot of discussion about in the early 20th century among, some of you may know about Russian formalism, for example, and there, which is basically a kind of a theory about how something becomes art, where art is in a way providing its own kind of truth, and the theory is basically the idea that you somehow sublimate or raise up lower sensations, lower stories, folklore, right, and you raise it to a more sublime kind of level. And I think that some of the, and they talk about various devices and ways of focusing the mind and so forth that enable you to do that. And I think that there might be something in the way that Coiré talks about both mathematics and experimentation, and maybe quite similar to this, in terms of how it is that you kind of structure your organization of the to understand the empirical world, so that ends up giving you a much more sublime experience. It opens you to a wider range of truth than you would get otherwise. But I haven't done the work on that. But I do think that kind of thing would be worth pursuing in the future. Now, another thing I think is kind of interesting, and this goes to your point, perhaps about the relationship between Cassirer and Coiré. There is an interesting article. Some of you may know that there is this Blackwell Handbook to Continental Philosophy. And there's a chapter in that on Cassirer, written by Michael Friedman, the analytic philosopher, where the final part of it actually is a discussion about the relationship between Cassirer and Coiré on the issue of the role of mathematics in the scientific revolution, and the role of mathematics generally as a kind of vehicle of intellectual change. And one of the points that Friedman makes, which I think is quite interesting, is that, you know, whatever kind of view, that there's a sense in which Cassirer's view of mathematics is an incredibly, in a way, a certain kind of very creative view of mathematics. That in a sense, we start to get new understandings of the world being generated by mathematics as it develops, you know, not only during the time of the scientific revolution, but beyond that in the 19th century and so forth, opening up new spheres of reality. And so in that sense, mathematics, you know, it's kind of like a generative a priori, in a sense. Whereas with Coiré, it seems that mathematics, as it were, provides a kind of window to a reality that's pre-existent. This is where Coiré is with Meyerson, right? And I think you were making that point, right? That there's a sense in which that the mathematics is, at the end of the day, a kind of instrument for opening your mind to a pre-existent reality. It is not the means by which the reality is being generated, okay? So Coiré is definitely not a constructivist. Okay, whatever he may be, whereas Cassirer may be a kind of constructivist, kind of mathematical constructivist. And I think that's kind of interesting too, given the sort of, metaphysics that tend to be fashionable these days, there may be grounds for wanting to recover some of that Coiré view of the world, especially among people who call themselves scientific realists. I would have thought that there's a kind of, you could find Coiré there also. How much more time do I have? Would you say?
About 15 minutes.
What to say? Because I don't want to just unleash all kinds of nonsense that then you can't really deal with. Well, look, one thing I do think that from my own point of view, the kind of double truth doctrine that somebody like Coiré, and I believe also Leo Strauss, was very much in favor of, though they had different ways of expressing it, they nevertheless were sort of on the same track, is quite different from the version that you see in Kuhn. Because I also say that Kuhn, and Kuhn is very famous for talking about the need for an Orwellian history of science for the scientists. Right, so the scientists, in a way, have to have a sort of deliberately self-misunderstood history in order to be inspired to continue doing science, because if they actually knew the real mess that constituted the history of science, they'd lose motivation entirely. And this is where Stephen Brush wrote the famous article in the 70s, you know, should history of science be rated X, right, for scientists? Okay, but this seems to me quite a different notion of double truth. From the kind that Coiré is talking about, and where with Coiré it's a much more classical Platonic one, where in a sense the elite people who are the scientists actually do have the access to the truth, and it's the common people who are living the noble lie. Whereas with Kuhn, kind of ironizes this, you might say, right, in terms of his understanding of what kind of history scientists need to have. They need to have the false history, right? So that's a kind of an interesting thing there. And the question is, you know, when one gets into those kinds of historiographical issues and one takes them as very central to what one's doing, because I think this is central to Kuhn and to Coiré, it makes you wonder to what extent these people can be properly called historians in the professional sense that we use it today. Okay, and I've always thought that both Coiré and Kuhn are primarily philosophers. They are historicist philosophers, okay? And that there's a sense in which while it's, you know, and so that when one talks about whether a scientific revolution ever took place, this is not just a simple empirical judgment, this is a normative judgment, right? Because there's a sense in which where there's a distinctive form of knowledge that has, as it were, privileged access to the truth that comes about at a certain time. So you're not talking about everything that happens in the 17th century. You're actually talking about quite a specific thing that you think is more important than everything else. Right? And then the issue becomes, what were the circumstances under which that came? And why do you want to understand the circumstances under which that came? Because you're trying to maintain it and you're hoping you don't lose it. And so from that standpoint, knowing the history is important, because there might be some very particular conditions of possibility that we might be, well, you know, in the verge of losing in some way or another, okay? And I think that is something that was very much part of the mind of Kuhn, of Coiré, I think of a lot of these people of this generation. They weren't trying to settle an empirical matter here. They were trying to settle something about the form of knowledge that they thought was the premier form of knowledge, and what they regarded in many cases as very precarious conditions under which it existed. Okay, I think all of this looks a little bit different now because we have a professional history of science community that, as it were, is an end in itself. Right? History of science is its own field, right? It's very, you might say, very evidence-driven. And in a way, you know, from that standpoint, a lot of these bigger normative questions, you know, look kind of misposed. Right? And that's always kind of the response that you get. What? The scientific revolution never happened, or millions of them happened. Right? But there is no sensible question about just one of them happening. Right? But that's, of course, because it's a normative issue. And so in that respect, I think that both Coiré and Kuhn remain very much philosophers. Okay? But I do think at the end, by the way, this is somebody was making a comment about, you know, why does Coiré give so much time to people like Nicholas of Cusa and Bruno and all these crackpots? Well, I think this fits very much with the kind of cosmist perspective, which of course takes all these people very seriously as talking about, you know, humanity being one with the kind of infinite universe and launch pad to becoming God and all that. And I think that kind of theology is very much part of what's informing what Coiré is getting at. And then the brilliance of science is you actually get it in some kind of mathematical, experimental, decidable form, so it's no longer crackpot, okay? But nevertheless, as part of the background story, you need to include all that other sort of stuff. So I would say, and I'll just conclude with this, because I'm actually interested in what other people have to say about this, I'm a little surprised the Slavophile side of Coiré hasn't come out, because I think what that does is it gives a real strong philosophical motivation for why Coiré would pitch the nature of the scientific revolution the way it is, and, you know, especially the significance of the idea of moving from the closed world to the infinite universe. And I'll stop here.
Thank you so much.